And now I'm going to pass out one more time some rules from California and the ABA model code. I took them out of the dining of the hall last night, and if you meant to hang on to it, you'll get a copy in your folder of the rules with the commentaries and discussion. So I'm passing out now. These are rules on communication. So and to give a presentation about these rules, I would like to introduce Mary Mosin and one Mo time, Charlie Halpern.
I think it's on, isn't it? Yes?
Is this turned on? I don't think so.
No, it doesn't.
Try it.
Hello?
Yep.
Good. Well, in keeping with the spirit of the evening, I want to start off with a couple of announcements. there'll be a volleyball game tomorrow morning. actually, I have one piece of good news and one piece of news that, from my point of view, isn't so good. The good news is that the person who taught me Qigong, who is a true internationally recognized master named Franz Mokel, is going to be doing 2 one-day workshops in this immediate area on May 20th and May 21st, Saturday and Sunday. And if there was a lot of interest in this practice, and a chance to do this with him for a day would be really wonderful. My suggestion to get information, it's right down the road in Kentfield, and my suggestion is to go to his, or to write to his email address. May 8th with James. Just Franz, May 20th and 21st, somewhere else. And his email address, how do you get?
I'll email it.
Doug will email it. I'm going to be at the Sunday one. He's really a wonderful teacher. And either May 8th, James? Here. Well, you can check the website. Good. Okay, my other announcement, which I think will be less controversial, is that I have to leave tonight. Thank you. I really feel terrible about it. I feel even worse because I have an 8 a.m. flight out of Oakland to Denver. The only consolation I have is it's another effort for me to continue to work with people around the question of how to bring the contemplative mind into the larger society. So I feel like I'm doing good work, much as I would really prefer to be here with you to finish out what has been for me a really rich and rewarding experience, for which I thank you all. So those are my only announcements. I hope you aren't disappointed by their brevity.
I can wait till tomorrow.
Our evening is the title of our evening is The Ethical Dimensions of Communications in the Practice of Law. Communications, we believe, Mary and I, are central in the practice of law, and meditation can help with communications to increase the effectiveness of lawyering and to increase the satisfaction in lawyering. I was thinking about this, my presentation here tonight, last weekend, and got into a conversation with Sadie Halpern, who is my 2-year-old granddaughter. And one of her reflections gave me an insight for our program today. In the course of our conversation, she said that she knew the ABCs. I said, that doesn't seem likely. You just turned 2. So she then went through this little recitation, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And it was a masterful performance, A to Z. And what I realized kind of halfway through around KLMNO was that she didn't know those were different things, KLMNO. She thought that was one verbal cluster, KLMNO. So the insight I had after I reflected on that was that so much of what lawyers' communication with clients, what lawyers tell clients, often are just they are saying words without, you know, to say them because they're in part of an important of a formula of passing information along, and the issue of comprehension and understanding really isn't a necessary part of the package. And you know, Sadie knew something about what she was reciting, but she certainly didn't have the concept of a letter down. Now that is the text, and with that I take a look at Rule 3500 that each of you have in front of you in the California Rules of Professional Conduct. A member shall keep a client reasonably informed about significant developments. First of all, when I read this thing, I don't do that much regular lawyering. I see something like Rule 3500, and I immediately click into lawyer mind. And I start to read this like a statute. And I say, see, a member shall keep a client reasonably informed. So you don't have to tell them too much. You know, you just this is when they say you haven't told them enough, you say, well, I've kept you reasonably informed. That's all I'm required to do. And he says, but there were important developments. I said, but I only have to inform you of significant developments. So even if I didn't keep you reasonably informed, still it wasn't a significant development. And then, as if to make the point even clearer, it says, including promptly complying with reasonable requests for information, none of those unreasonable requests, please, and copies of significant documents when necessary to keep the client informed. So even if it was a reasonable request and it was a significant document, I still can say, well, it wasn't necessary to keep you informed. So this looks like a wonderful document. It sets a minimum standard for lawyer communications and a narrow range of lawyer work, and it does so in a way that thoroughly protects the lawyer. Anybody who reads this knows it wasn't drafted by the client counsel. This was drafted by lawyers for lawyers. Now, it was a little startling to me.
Read the comment, because it really...
Oh.
The very first line, isn't it? It says this is meant to...
Rule 3500 is not intended to change a member's duties to his or her clients. It's intended to make clear that while a client must be informed of significant developments in the matter, a member will not be disciplined for failing to communicate insignificant or irrelevant information. So it says, dear reader, don't lose any sleep over it. So in a way, it invites what I might call a Sadie Halpern approach to communication. That you say the words so they're heard, and if there's ever if you're ever deposed or you can say, well, I said those words, and I said, did you hear me? And they say, yes, I heard every word you said. But it's a very limited you might say, an extremely minimal approach to the subject of communication. Now, I want to draw attention to a couple of other aspects of this rule. First of all, it is again a point that has arisen several times. It only talks about communication from the point of view of speaking or presenting a written document. It doesn't have anything. There's nothing said about the receiver of this document or the lawyer's role as a receiver of information. There is no minimal duty to receive information from a client and to understand what the client's goals are. The entire focus of the rule is on the explicit verbal content. Now, James gave us some insight into the way communication really works in his talk this morning. He said that 55% of the communication is body language, 38% is tone, and 7% is content. That's how information passes between two people. Well, you might say, you know, these are approximate numbers. You know, we don't know what the survey conditions were. We're talking about a lawyer-client relationship where people may be more attentive. So let's say the content is significantly more important than 7%. Say that it's 20% or 30%. It still means that the core of the communication process between the lawyer and the client isn't addressed at all. The stuff which goes through body language, emphasis, tone of voice, the way we speak. Which, if you think about it, is precisely the way we lawyers are educated to look at the world. We are trained to look at words on a page and to sort out in our oral communications expressions of emotion or non-rational, cognitive way pieces of information. We sort that out. I remember vividly, as if it were not so many decades ago, an experience I had with my first year civil procedure teacher when one of my classmates, we used to wear suits and ties and stand to speak, and my civil procedure teacher, one of my students made the mistake, this is in the first semester of law school, of saying that he felt that one case was wrongly decided. And the professor said to him, "You what?" He said, "Well, I felt that it was wrongly decided." He said, "I don't care how you feel. Nobody in this room cares how you feel. We want to know what the court held." Well, that was an indelible impression on me. And it set one of the ground rules for legal education as was practiced then and is largely practiced now. I mean, I think probably the violence of the professorial response would be muted today. But the message would be the same. The way you feel about this is not what we're here to talk about. So already, when we are thinking about communication in our first year of law school, when we're thinking about civil procedure, we are narrowing our vocabulary and narrowing the kind of information that we want to take in or the kind of information that we're putting it out. So the word feelings is taboo, and it takes with it, it pulls out a large part of the vocabulary that describes the richness of human relationships. Now, what I want to suggest is that the meditative perspective gives us a different approach to the communications problem, one that's fully consistent with the bar's very minimal requirement of adequate communication, but one which is actually aspirational in character. We're not just talking about what you can be disbarred for failing to do this, but we're talking about what's the aspiration to be an effective lawyer and to be a person who draws the greatest satisfaction from the law practice. And it's, as I say, it's consistent with the bar's recommendations, and it's one which I suggest really does contribute to effectiveness and satisfaction. Let me suggest three dimensions of what we who have a meditative perspective would add in to the communications process after it's been stripped down by the way we were taught and acculturated and by the message that the bar gives us. The first thing is mindful listening. We had a wonderful we've had some wonderful exercises in mindful listening here today and yesterday. And my suggestion is that carrying that back into our law practice is a way to become better lawyers and find deeper satisfaction in it. There is a notion of being fully present for a client. These clients come to lawyers often with problems that they consider overwhelming and disproportionate to the ordinary decisions that they have to deal with in their life, and their ordinary troubles in life. That's why they've come to a lawyer. And there is a way of being fully present and listening to them the way we were listening to each other this afternoon in our small groups. Now, that's not easy to do. First of all, we're in a hurry. And we don't want to hear a lot of stuff that isn't legally relevant. We're already, when the client comes in, as soon as they say their name and why they're there, we're starting to think about how do we turn their problem into a legal complaint or an answer or some legal document. And anything that they want to talk about, what's hurting them, we want to get to the point of preparing a legal document. And there are subtle ways. Unfortunately, this is an area where I have a lot of work to do. I have lots of ways to show people I'm in a hurry. One, and most lawyers do, by the way. You know, I have two more minutes. Most lawyers do. One is by having your secretary call you, if you have a secretary, and say your next appointment is here. The other is, one of the things that I was told when I was in active law practice was that the state of my desk said, I'm in a hurry. And that anybody who knew how to read my desk got the message that they should talk crisply. I used to have a very unfortunate expression, which I don't use anymore, which was, can you give me the Reader's Digest version? I actually used to say that to people, not to clients, but that was a way of being busy. So that's one thing, mindful listening. A second thing that the meditative perspective adds on and supplements, this is really I'm thinking about supplements to Rule 3500. A second thing, establishing trust. The most important thing between a client and lawyer is that the client trusts the lawyer. And that doesn't just automatically happen. And the assumption that that's automatically going to happen, because look, of course they should trust us. Our code of professional responsibility tells us that we owe you this fiduciary duty. Well, clients don't necessarily understand that, and particularly if you're talking across a gap of race and class and educational accomplishment and language skill, it's often very hard to get to establish that trusting relationship. When I was dean at CUNY Law School, and our first class was coming in 1981 or two, I had the assumption that we were going to become a trusting community. It's not just lawyer-client. But I had assumed that we were going to be a trusting community. But it doesn't work that way. One of the students very early said to me, somebody who worked their way through the CUNY system in 8 years to get a BA from Baruch going to school while working as a full-time emergency room medic or something, they came in and said, everybody in the CUNY system always says, trust me. You know, I have your best interest at heart. He says, I'll never believe that again. And as soon as somebody says, trust me, this was like the first day with CUNY's first group of students. The first time someone says, trust me, I want to make sure that I'm close to the exit. So I wonder, when we're thinking about how do we meditative lawyers supplement 3-500 in thinking about taking communication seriously and becoming effective practitioners, thinking hard about how we establish trust is one thing I want to emphasize. My last point is this. When my most of my years of active practice were in the social justice world, doing test case litigation on behalf of mentally ill and mentally retarded people. Obviously, the communications problems there were horrendous. You know, you're dealing with somebody with an IQ of 70, and he's your client. So, that's one cluster of problems. But I think it's important that we all think about not only the specifics of how we represent clients in a social justice context, but think generally about the attorney's role as a public citizen. We've talked a great deal about the traditional lawyer-client relationship in traditional bipolar litigation. I want to suggest that each of us who really has the meditative perspective deeply within has a larger obligation to function as a public citizen, to take those unique skills and that unique capacity we have to affect the way decisions are made in this country. And we use that systematically for the public good, whether or not we're representing a client in a particular matter or helping to organize a community group or giving pro bono advice to a nonprofit organization. All of those are situations which are part of the lawyer's responsibilities. And I want to suggest that in the meditative perspective amendment to Rule 3-500, we all take into account the communications problems which arise in that larger context where there isn't simply a conversation between a client and a lawyer.
Like a wildfire that spreads really quickly.
Mary?
I want to share with you some thoughts about communication and about lawyer-client relationship. There was an article by Bar President Jim Heitig, I don't know, a few months ago, and he called it sitting in the client's chair. You know, he has an opinion in the Bar Journal and the newspaper that comes out. He has an op-ed piece every year, every month. And it was about what a terrible experience he and his family had when he was younger, because they needed a lawyer and they hired somebody with great reputation, and it turned out okay. But the experience itself was terrible because the lawyer didn't talk to them at all and spent all of his time schmoozing with opposing counsel. And that's when he decided to go to law school. He said, I don't want to treat people like that. I will do better. And then he confessed that he doesn't always do better. But that was impressive to me that he was noticing and urging lawyers to sit in the client's chair, to put yourself in the place of the client. And if you can do that, then I think that makes a big difference in the communication. You talk to somebody differently if you have some sense of what they need to hear, what they expect to hear. And I think you can also, it helps you to listen better. If you have some sense of what it must feel like to be the one who doesn't know and the one who needs to be kind of educated and the one, in fact, with the information that the lawyer needs. If you're the client, you know you have that information, but you don't know just what it is that the lawyer needs. And as somebody brought up about a client that was really upset, you know, it may be that the client needs to vent and the lawyer needs to be sensitive enough to notice that and to maybe listen at least once, really listen. And I want to emphasize, you know, Charlie mentioned the fiduciary relationship. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. We owe the highest duty to our clients. And so that duty fleshes out this cover your ass rule. No, because we actually do owe them our best. And I wanted to tell you a couple of stories. I noticed when we were talking about the settlement offer, and there was also talk about, you know, about how to evaluate a settlement offer, and there was some about criminal defense issues, and people were talking about how to make a decision, and maybe you should go down the hall and talk to a colleague and so on. Nobody mentioned talking to the client. Nobody. And it's the client's decision. And I know it's not always easy and sometimes impossible because the client just kind of won't participate with you, no matter what you do. I've represented unions and labor contract negotiations with a bargaining committee that just sat there and said, yes, whatever I said, they just said, oh, okay. And that was actually a terrible experience to be making decisions about their lives without any real participation by them. Whether I could have listened better, maybe. I had a different experience with the bargaining committee that I represented at Stanford. And I wanted to share that with you because it was a wonderful experience of communication. Because they really wanted to, they took their responsibility seriously, and they wanted to hear what I had to say, and they wanted to understand what Stanford was offering. And then they talked about it, and they told me, you know, kind of what to do. We came together to decisions about what to do and what the next step would be. And it was not easy. I've talked in different contexts about the lawyer on the other side being very difficult for me. But working with that committee was a great joy because they were really listening to me and to each other and to management. So there was real communication both ways. So I wish that for you, and I don't mean to say that it's always possible or that we're in control of that, because we're not in control of, you know, how the client's going to respond. But I wanted to underline at least trying to include the client, it being, after all, their case and their money and their life and their jail time or whatever it might be. And I want to say one other thing about listening. It's just a story, really, where I felt like I learned a lot about listening to a client. I represented the folks on the Navajo Reservation that work for the Indian Health Service hospitals. And it was a standby pay case. And it was a public sector laborers case, and we represented them in the Western United States. And so I was in lovely downtown Chinle, which is where the Canyon de Chelly is, and meeting with a group of people that worked at that particular hospital for the first time about this grievance that the union had filed. And most of them had about when they were lab techs and x-ray techs and nursing assistants, things like that. So they weren't professional, but they were kind of the support people. And so, the rule for most of them was that they had to be back at work in 15 minutes. So I said, oh, then you can't do the things you usually do, can you? You couldn't have people over for dinner. I just got these blank stares. At which point I decided maybe I better start listening. And so instead of telling them what they couldn't do, I asked them what they couldn't do, and I learned, I had a wonderful time. I learned a tremendous amount about both Navajo and Hopi life on the reservation. And we used it, and we won quite a bit. But just that sense of, because I wasn't a meditator yet, but still that sense of paying attention and noticing the nonverbal communication. Because nobody said to me, well, that was a stupid thing to say, you yuppie from San Francisco. You know, it's not that they don't ever have people over for dinner, but it's much more of a family kind of an event. So it's not like a dinner party most of the time, unless it's a ceremony out at the family land, which is way, way far away, that kind of thing. Never mind. Oh, going on a bit. But, anyway, the communication was nonverbal. And it doesn't talk about that, as I think you said. It doesn't talk about that at all. Noticing that however many percent. So we have to define these rules. It says we need to communicate with our clients enough that they understand the case and that they understand any settlement offers and so on. And there's, you know, some of the language isn't so bad. There are all these reasonable, because they are, especially when you read the commentaries, they do seem like cover your ass rules. But we have the chance here to really understand them in a different way, to take them deeper and to dedicate ourselves to really communicating with our clients in all aspects. So I hope we can do that, and I look forward to conversations about it. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. So now we're going to get back into our medium-sized groups. There will be now a fourth group for students. So students, please come join Richard and Judy. We'll be leading the group, and that group is going to be meeting in the council house, which is the room next to the manager's office. We're going to have 25 minutes for this session. I'm going to ring the bell. I'm sorry for the tightness in the schedule, but perhaps it's a lot of our lives are probably like this, so we could take our mindful practice now of silently moving to our meeting spot into next. No, the teachers will do a little talk and facilitate. So I'm going to ring the large bell outside, so when you hear it, please just stop the conversation and come back in silence. Thank you.
That crisp communication.
Right.
So we don't have much time, but let's use it and see if we can go straight to the heart of stuff that's either troubling you or you're really concerned about coming out of this conversation, knowing that we're not going to have much time. Are the things that people feel are, and it is our last time to talk together like this, things coming out of this conversation
sometimes in the midst of a long retreat, we can start to
that feel important. It's, we're all here together. We've just been in this other group, and really this is a time for, if something came from that group that feels important to you to raise here, or there's a hanging question about family that I said we would get to at some point. This may be that point. You look tired. And but this is an important time. Yeah. Tim?
My daughter was 18. I took her out to breakfast before she went to college to apologize for the fact that I'd let my career get in the way of our relationship. It was a three-hour breakfast. This was before I started meditating, but I knew that I'd really blown it by being busy. It was more complicated than that. When I was 41 and she was 9, I was diagnosed with a cancer that they thought was terminal. And so I really kind of hid from the family for a lot of reasons, dealing with trying to protect myself and protect them from what we didn't know. And I guess what I wanted to say was that you got to be careful, because the career is also a place to hide out. And you don't even know you're hiding. And Meredith and I have, this is the daughter I mentioned the other day that wanted to go to law school and then decided to do high school social studies. But the wonderful thing about it is that children can be forgiving. And you can really open up a great wide space. And I'm really sorry I lost those years, but I'm also extremely happy to have had the last 6 or 8 where I'm not hiding out in my career. And she knows it. And I actually did it with each kid one at a time. I don't know if I could have opened up to everybody all at once, because there was so much built up. But they'll take you back.
Thank you. So we're on to at least the personal and the professional and balance. Is that a theme that people want to talk about? Is there more? Are the things that came up from this? I actually have no idea what the conversations were like in the other groups. Where are you?
It's one of the postures. It's a valid point.
Our group, I don't know about the other groups either, but our group did talk about communication specifically.
But then, you know, when
communication with clients, which was what Charlie and Mary both presented about, and it was actually, I thought, a really interesting group, because everybody in the group had a different, there were different, you know, people practicing law in different areas, and in every area there was a different way of, it was a whole different system of communicating with the client. And most of the people had worked out a pretty good system for a thorough and sensitive communication, each one completely different. And a couple of the people had figured out key questions. You know, when a client comes in, I ask this, or I say this to elicit communication. So I thought it was very instructive and inspiring. And one of the people in the group, I hope I'm not misrepresenting this, I think was saying, And I'm not sure that I do that good a job communicating with my clients, but this conversation makes me think about that and how to do that differently, so that, which I found very kind of moving, and it was really a moment of truth and something beautiful. So amazingly, we stayed on topic, and it all worked out. So that's a little report, I suppose, about our group.
Can we get you the mic?
My name's Jeff. I was in the law students group, so I didn't say anything brilliant then, but I'll say it now for the...
Oh, saving it for the lawyers.
For the larger group. Now, I've been a backbencher all weekend, so I thought I'd say something. Last summer, I worked at a legal aid, and I was doing some housing stuff, and I was able to help this one client. I mean, obviously, at the direction of this attorney, he would say, can you go meet him at the bus stop? Can you do this or that? A lot of the stuff I was doing wasn't, super important legal matters, but it was still spending time with this guy. And he was in public housing and had some difficulties. And it was really important to him after I went and saw his place to, introduce me to all of his goldfish. And, and then he wanted to take me to this coffee shop where he goes, and he wanted to, buy my coffee. It meant a lot to him. That was his way of saying thank you. And, and I talked with this guy for, 2 or 3 hours because I wasn't really getting used in the office anyway. And I thought, my computer is still broken. I've been there for 2 weeks. I can learn the names of all of his goldfish, I can interview him. But, I remember walking back to the firm or this place and knowing that, nobody was really missing me. But I knew one day I'm not going to have this time. I'm not important. I'm not needed right now. I mean, I'm training, I'm learning. Nobody missed me. I came back in, I slipped in. But, I remember thinking to myself, nothing that happened in the last 3 hours was really legally relevant, but it was all very important, to him, and it was important to me, too, to get to know this guy. So it's just bittersweet because I thought, I'm blessed because I could talk with this guy today, but there will be a day when, I'll be cutting people like this off, too.
Mm-hmm. And what was important for you?
He didn't want just he looked at me like I was a lawyer. He didn't know, he didn't make those distinctions. I was a helper, and that meant a lot to him. And, I was a hero to him like anybody else in the office. But, he wanted more than a professional relationship. He wanted to know me. It was important for him to say, who are you, and why are you here, and why are you helping, and, let me tell you what I did last weekend. And I wanted to hear those things, too. But, I had the time to hear him, too. So
it sounds like the quality of that connection is something you'd want to have, even if you didn't have the time. The challenge would be how to do it without going to the coffee shop and see the goldfish.
Yeah, one day when hours are billable and all that, you can't do that. So
it's kind of a wonderful image to carry. Mm-hmm. Judy? Go ahead.
Sorry. We do civil litigation, and there's an attorney in my office that really spends probably much more time than anybody else does with the clients. And to us, it's either you win or you lose. So, I mean, the clients are, if you win, they're pretty happy, actually. But his entire wall is filled with thank you letters from clients. I think it's largely because he has a personal as opposed to purely professional relationship with him. And it's always it's a kind of a wonder to walk in there and see all these thank yous over the years. Mm. It's very nice.
Mm. And it sounds like he's also, that's what he's advertising, right?
Well, I think it comes from the heart.
Yeah, I mean that in the best sense, that he's, what he's communicating is there are other clients that I've had a personal connection with.
Oh, yeah.
And so
yeah.
That's what the invitation is.
I think also he uses it to inspire himself to go up for the next client.
I guess I want to third that and say that it's true that the billable hour rules, and that's a sad thing a lot of the time. But it's also true that, at least in my practice, the human connection is the only connection. So my client relationships are real relationships with my clients. It's not to say that with every client I have a deep personal relationship. Not at all. But I have... The reason my clients come back to me when there's lots of other lawyers and law firms that they could go to is because of the relationship. And the way that I have built those relationships is by listening to them talk about their goldfish or whatever it is that they want to talk about. I had a client call in complete distress who I sent to Edith. it's her field. It's her field, not because I couldn't. But he had previously been a real estate client. And he called me in the middle of one of those totally insane days and said, I have to come talk to you right now. And I said, fine. And he came over, and we sat for 20 minutes. And I think it meant a lot to him. Anyway, that's what he needed, and I'm a counselor.
Yeah, over here.
I'm still in school, so I haven't had that many clients that I've interacted with, but there was one guy who... He got thrown in prison for allegedly raping a 94-year-old woman. He was 18. And it turned out that he didn't do it. So he sort of went through this whole process. He was very upset, as you might imagine. It was pretty hard for him. His name is in the papers and everything. And what he really wanted was an apology. One thing that's kind of unfortunate about a lot of the litigation in our society, that's not necessarily something you'll be able to get. I mean, you may in mediation. But you can't force, you know, a city or a police officer to own up to their mistakes. So I got to go and hang out with him and talk with him. And sort of by just talking to him and relating to him and showing empathy and sympathy, I could sort of try to give a little bit of what he needed, which he couldn't get out of the litigation that he was part of. And I think that meant a lot to him, and it meant a lot to me.
I went and began the retreat. Diana? Oops. There's a backbencher. She gets priority.
Hi, I'm also a law student, so this isn't exactly going to be... Well, it is a personal experience, but it's sort of indirect. Anyway, my father was an attorney, and I think was really happy with his career on the whole and had a pretty relaxed and kind of satisfying life with it. And he died when I was in high school. And about 3 or 4 years after he died, I was checking in at the airport, and the guy behind the ticket counter looked at my license and said, "Oh, Waxman. Oh, was your father that attorney, Jonathan Waxman?" I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, oh yeah, oh, you know, yeah, he represented my father, yeah, you know. And I went and checked in and sat down, and a few minutes later he walked up to me and he handed me a first class ticket. And he said, he said, you know, your dad, you know, he really helped out my dad. And, you know, I always remember this one time he came up and he had some firewood, and he brought us some firewood. And, you know, I just wanted to do something for his daughter. And so, I mean, not to say that obviously, not, you know, I'm not going to bring firewood to all your clients or anything, but I think just there's a way that being, because people don't expect attorneys necessarily to be human or to connect in a human way, I think that can just have a really big impact on the client, and I think that also just makes a really big difference in how you find your own practice, and I guess so. That's, you know,
and also I imagine I'm the lawyer's daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
And might be one of the things that fuels her wanting to become a lawyer.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. So we're going to stop now because we run out of time, not out of interesting things to say.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.